The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Want the real story behind the sound bites and headlines? Let's find the facts. Remember, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's the truth. You are not paranoid or confused. You just need to know.
Hey, everybody, it's time for another edition of Everything You Need to Know. I'm Kip Kiefer, and join you at this time each and every week to give my thoughts on some things that are happening in our world, and sometimes even take a bizarre exit that you don't expect and go different directions. Today, we're going to keep it on plane in terms of sort of the theme today, which is how art actually does imitate life. If you consider most written works art, which I think most of us would probably paint it with that broad brush, I'm going to talk about a novel that I know you all have heard of. I wonder how many of you have read it, and I wonder how many of you did read it because you were forced to in high school or maybe even the early stages of college and have forgotten exactly the message and a lot of the content in there. That book, of course, is 1984 by George Orwell. Now, I need for full disclosure to tell you that George Orwell was a pen name for the actual author. His name was Eric Allan Blair, born in 1903 in India, of English parents, spent most of his life in London as a journalist and a literary critic, and in the latter parts of his life, a novelist. He wrote two very, very important books, one of them, Animal Farm, and the other one, of course, 1984, which sadly was published shortly before his death in 1950. The book was published in 1949. Orwell had, in the later stages of writing 1984, contracted a severe case of tuberculosis, which ended up being the end of him in terms of his human experience at the age of 47, survived World War II, and then was taken down by TB. But he did get his book published in 1949. So if you look at it from that perspective now, we are 70 plus years in from when that book was created and published. And Orwell, of course, naming his book 1984, there are so many amazing parallels in that book that he foresaw that are part of our regular routine today. And I wanted to call some of those things to your attention. And that's what we're going to do today on Need to Know. Of course, 1984, Orwell was a little pessimistic, I guess, in the speed that a lot of these things would unfold. Having written his book some 34 years before. So he was a little early with 1984, but now here in 2023, which is 39 years later, the premise of Orwell's genius work was right on target. He just was 39 years premature. So with all that said, let's get into it today on Need to Know. Now, I want to start off by saying that the idea to kind of bring you this particular subject matter was triggered by a flurry of activity in the last couple of weeks in America's courts, including the Supreme Court, and one very significant decision that really ties into the George Orwell discussion in a district court from a lawsuit that was filed that really was a profound ruling. It will be very interesting to see what happens now as that decision moves through the appeals court and then ultimately perhaps the Supreme Court. You listen to commentators and analysts, and the worst word used now improperly in the English language, quote, experts, unquote, for their interpretations of a lot of these court decisions that have come down. And you can almost set your watch to the fact that what their reaction is going to be is not based on any kind of legal training or expertise in our Constitution, which is the driving document for everything that the courts are supposed to do, whether they be on the state level, where there are state constitutions to abide by, or, of course, the United States Constitution, which always legislates any federal situation. And these analysts, based on their partisanship, based on their ideology and party affiliation, always weigh in on the side of the issue that best fits their politics. And that is a real flaw in what our system is supposed to be. I know you're probably tired of my parrot-like dissertation each and every week, seemingly on this show, that we have a brilliant founding document with a lot of principles that are timeless and were brilliantly conceived. And those, of course, resulted in the Constitution from our forefathers and the framers. Those guys came up with a system that was just brilliant in terms of how it was put together, focusing on three branches of federal government: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. Those are the three. And each and every one has checks and balances put in place to make sure that no one entity of those three has absolute power. There's ability for those entities to check one another in appropriate times to make sure that we always have a government by the people, for the people. That's the conception of our system, and those checks and balances ensure that that is the case. Remember, the Declaration of Independence doesn't say we, the government, in order to form a union that we completely control. That's not what it says. It says we, the people, in order to conceive a perfect union. And again, the power in this system is you and me and all of us around us, we, the people. That is the ultimate power. And anything that's done to usurp that power is a violation of the Founding Fathers' vision and a disservice and ultimately a destructive force in the American system. So some of these decisions this week have been much maligned and cried about by, you know, left-leaning and left-dominant critics. The Supreme Court struck down the admissions practice of many major universities, including almost every Ivy League institution. It was a lawsuit actually filed by an Asian American individual who had a perfect resume, had absolutely aced his test scores on all the required exams to get into Harvard, and was denied admission despite having a perfect resume and an outstanding academic background because there was no room for him after the affirmative action people that were granted admission despite not having anywhere near the credentials that this individual had were admitted to Harvard to make up some kind of, you know, the thing that we hear all the time, this diversity, equity, inclusion agenda. And if you think about it, it's really amazing that diversity, equity, inclusion comes at the expense of someone who is eminently qualified being denied an opportunity because there's no room at the inn for him once the social justice practice of putting people in that are not as qualified, and this is all people from all different walks of life that check the boxes now of all of the allegedly aggrieved and mistreated individuals based on their color or sexual proclivity or whatever category that, again, whatever box they check that gives them preferential treatment. Well, I mean, all of that's fine in theory. The whole DEI movement is fine in theory. But when the less qualified triumph and gain an opportunity over people that are eminently qualified, that's discrimination in its own right. That's discriminating against people that cannot be discriminated against based on the fact that they're just the odd man out. And in this case, it's particularly grievous because this was an Asian American filing this suit. And arguably, you could say that right now, Asian Americans, because of their work ethic, and you know, this is a stereotype, but it's happening so much in our society now. Recently in Virginia, it's come to light that some school boards have delayed announcing or publishing outstanding academic achievement and scholastic awards for Asian American students to allow the process to exclude them from greater opportunities. It's discrimination, no matter what you call it. If you're employing affirmative action to avoid discrimination and promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, you can't do it at the expense of discriminating against someone else for whatever reason. They're being stereotyped and put into the same box of Asian Americans are too high of achievers. We've got to penalize them. It just doesn't make any sense. So with all that being said, there were other Supreme Court decisions, the striking down of Joe Biden's executive order to pretty much forgive $800 billion in student loan debt. The Supreme Court struck down that act by Biden as unconstitutional because the president is not given that kind of authority. The power of the purse, the expenditure of funding, the forgiveness of debt have to be legislatively generated. The president is not the king. He cannot make that decision. And of course, logically, sure, it would be great if a bunch of people that have a lot of student loan debt could be forgiven of that. But the problem with that is people that had went to work for a living and never sought that kind of assistance and, you know, now stand back and watch people that were able to get that government help making hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of dollars. And now that debt is forgiven. I mean, if you're a plumber or someone in the service industry who went a different route, I mean, is that fair to you? That these people that have earned that opportunity through their schooling and have reached captain of industry positions and lucrative financial compensation, that they are now excused of that debt. So basically, people that went to work and have paid taxes and now are in a terrible period of inflation and elevated costs and massive debt for our country, for our future descendants, to excuse $800 billion in loans, you know, it really puts it right back on the backs of people that didn't go that route. So the Supreme Court didn't and is not charged with, this is what the big misunderstanding is, the Supreme Court does not make decisions or is not supposed to make decisions based on political ideology. They strictly interpret, is this act or what's being challenged in the court legal under the provisions of the Constitution? That's their job. That's their only job. And the reason that Supreme Court justices have lifetime appointments by the sitting president at the time is because if they ran for re-election and were raising funds for campaigns, et cetera, like typical politicians, they would be compromised. They need to be free of all compensation and outside influence and make decisions based on constitutional law. in a series of faux pas and ridiculous statements and completely baffling speeches and comments, our esteemed Vice President Kamala Harris, when she was a senator from California, voted against Justice Neil Gorsuch's appointment to the Supreme Court because, in her words, and now this is a trained lawyer, Kamala Harris, which you wouldn't know it by her dissertations, and also the former attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer in California. So the former attorney general, a trained lawyer, said she was having to vote against Neil Gorsuch, who was an Ivy League educated, brilliant judge, rated the highest that you could possibly be in all of the appropriate locations for that type of thing. She voted against Gorsuch because, quote, if you look at his resume, he makes all of his decisions based on legalisms, comma, not what's best for the people, unquote. So a trained lawyer, the former attorney general of California, is condemning Neil Gorsuch because he makes decisions based on legalisms. Well, legalism is a terrible term because I don't think it's even a word, but a legalism in her vernacular is a bad thing when that's his job as a sitting judge. He makes decisions based on the legal situation, the legal circumstances, not in the words of Kamala Harris. The decisions of the Supreme Court are not what's best for people. You can become a community activist if that's what you're interested in, not a Supreme Court justice. So I hope that every one of the Supreme Court justices will take their responsibility seriously and do nothing outside of voting for legalisms, because that's what they're up there and sitting on the bench to do. So let's get back to the 1984 thing. George Orwell wrote this brilliant novel, and I preface it with these Supreme Court decisions because there was a lower court decision that really triggered my associating the novel with modern day activity. And that decision was in this district court. It was in response to lawsuits from citizen activist groups and state's attorney generals in like 14 different jurisdictions, primarily authored by the attorney generals of Louisiana and Missouri, that challenged the Biden administration and the executive branch, including their Department of Justice and FBI, from having direct contact with social media and news outlets to object and insist in a lot of cases, and there's boodles of evidence that this judge considered that that directly pointed the fact that this has been a practice, including testimony from Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, outlining that they met once a week with Department of Justice or FBI officials to be alerted on possible, quote, disinformation that they should exclude from their sites or heavily censor. And, you know, some of the things that ran into that kind of censorship were things that just coincidentally that politically were running afoul of what they were trying to tell you at the executive branch, the White House, the presidency. And some of the prime examples in this lawsuit cited were the whole COVID story, starting us immediately with the origins of COVID, where the narrative was continuously sold by the executive branch's chief medical spokesperson, Dr. Tony Fauci, that basically this was a natural born disease coming from wet markets in China. It had bad origins that had effectively morphed and evolved into an agent that was capable of infecting human beings. When any person with a shred of common sense knew that this was a massive cover-up, because the National Institute of Health, which Fauci heads up, was giving money to the Echo Alliance, Bill Gates' worldwide fund that is spread around to all kinds of different agencies, including many in communist China. And the Wuhan lab of virology was given a lot of that money from the NIH via Echo Health. And they were using that for gain of function research to experiment with viruses, predominantly these aviary viruses, and spiking those with different proteins and different infecting agents that would make them a lot more difficult to shake and a lot easier to contract and make them more serious. Now, the excuse is, well, we had to experiment with that because you can't devise vaccines if by chance this possibly would ever evolve this way in nature. Well, that's just ridiculous. Let's create a virus that could possibly get out of our lab, which it did in China. And that is not a disputable fact anymore, despite the fact you'll still hear left commentators say, well, we don't know that for sure. Well, we damn well do. I knew it from day one because I have common sense. And if there's a lab working on making serious viruses even worse by tinkering with them and adding things that would make them a lot more communicable and also more serious, it didn't take a rocket science to put two and two together of what happened. So bottom line is that was a couple of the big things that basically the FBI and the DOJ, working at the behest of the White House, were urging these social media places to not allow people to comment on these things because it would go counter to the narrative they were trying to sell. You know what that is, folks? A blatant, unbelievable, shocking violation of the First Amendment, which ensures free speech and free expression of ideas. Every time, and I fell into this myself personally, if I would post anything in those areas questioning the narrative from Washington and from the swamp that we talk so much about here, I was either censored or sent a message that said, you better not do that anymore, or they would tag my post with something that people could click on to get alternate information. It was a complete, you know, violation of free speech. There are other categories too that in that time period that were mentioned in this lawsuit. Anything that you wrote on climate change, anything you wrote to question the whole, you know, ridiculous narrative that the most serious threat to our future is climate change and man has to reverse it tomorrow or we only have 10 or 12 years left on this earth, a planet that's been here for 4.5 billion years. If you wrote anything counter to that, Facebook was particularly heinous in this area. They would tack on this goofy clip, this goofy thing that people could click on that would allow them to go to a chart that showed how warming trends in the last 25 years had infected the earth. And I don't know if that was accurate. I don't care if it's accurate. If it was true, there's still no evidence that what man is doing, the Industrial Revolution that has only been going on for 140 years in this country, of different emissions and supposedly major carbon damage to the atmosphere that is causing this alleged climate change. And they cite more severe storms. I mean, lately you heard Eric Allen, the mayor of New York, say, well, you know, we've got this terrible air quality problem because of the fires in Canada. Ladies and gentlemen, you are witnessing climate change in action. BS. This happens all the time. If you look back at history, the first recorded incident was in 1780 when it was so bad that most of New England basically was in a dark fog for a couple of days before the wind direction changed. Canadian forest fires and wildfires are not a new phenomenon, and they are not caused by climate change. It's just lunacy. But you suggest such a thing, you get tagged at the bottom of your post, And again, maybe the climate's warming, maybe the sea temperature is hotter, maybe the polar ice cap is under some temperature siege. I don't know the facts. I'm not a scientist, but I do know this fact. Until they prove to me and others that are doubters in this area and stop using this as a great political tool for their advancement of ideas, here's the bottom line. That's the issue. If there's things going on from a planet that has been here 4.5 billion years, maybe it's just not that outrageous to suggest that the planet goes through cycles and makes changes that have nothing to do with what kind of car you drive or what kind of stove you cook on. The whole thing is absolute madness that no one has the right to question the narrative. And that's what 1984 comes in with the direct tie-in. 1984, George Orwell's brilliant novel, talks about Big Brother being in charge of the government. And Big Brother oversees and surveils everything its citizens are doing. And those examples I just gave you give you a real example of how that's happening in our modern world. In 1984, there were giant screens in all public places with someone lecturing you about what you needed to think. In fact, that person was from what was called in the book, the Ministry of Thought. And the practice of new speak was being propagated amongst all the citizens. New speak was to use language differently and not use it to dissent in any way or show any kind of knowledge or interest in things the government was telling you. You were just supposed to comply. There was also a thought police who would accost and arrest and detain and submit for reprogramming anyone who stepped out of line and, God forbid, thought for themselves. The thought police, had slogans like ignorance is strength. And the government, had the motto that I find fascinating, that the past controls the present. And the present, the power that's in charge in the present controls the past. So you erase history, you tell people what you think that will fit your narrative, and you demand that they comply. Sound familiar? I think that's what's happening right now. So George Orwell, his forecast some 73 years ago, absolutely spot on. If you haven't read 1984, or if you read it many years ago and forgotten it, you can get it on audio version. It's of course available anywhere books are sold. Enlighten yourself and see what a foretelling of the future that Eric Allen Blair, aka pen name George Orwell, forecast, because the parallels are chilling in this world that we live in today. Just some food for thought here, some things I thought maybe that you needed to know, maybe some things you already knew but had not thought about. But the old phrase, history repeats itself, is absolutely true. And you can find so many parallels, not just in literature, not just in traditional history that's not been altered or revised. And that gives me hope that we will get this world back on track and get it straightened out and have America return to its founding principles of free speech, individual liberty, and most important, a government of the people, by the people, for the people. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. I enjoyed bringing it to you as I do each and every week. Don't forget, Kiefer and Curry will be back this week as well with our latest broadcast, and always look forward to teaming up with the great Tony Curry and kicking around all kinds of subjects of interest. That happens every week here on TKR. If you don't already have the app and you're catching us on one of the Apple platforms, be sure to download it because it is well worth it. Great programming. TKR, proud to be a part of it. And proud to have you all in my listening audience. I'm Kip Kiefer. With everything you need to know, we'll talk to you again next week.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.